Yes, I think we're recording. Okay, well, greetings to all our brothers and sisters over there in Canada and the United States. My name is John Joseph May, and I am a Christian. I would like to tell you a little bit about my family first and how we became Jehovah's Witnesses. In 1954, two missionaries called, and my father was a man who loved truth. He had left the Union because he refused to tell lies, and he was disenchanted with the Catholic Church because he knew they were teaching lies but couldn't quite put his finger on it, until some missionaries called from Jehovah's Witnesses, and they were very nice people, very kind people, and they showed him. And he was thrilled to discover the truth about God's purpose. So I was 9 years old at the time, and there was a violent domestic explosion, as the 1958 yearbook mentions, in under Era, or Ireland. And it was the story about my father, John Patrick May. And my mother and he, who deeply loved each other, were tragically divided over this. And there was a huge court case, and my father lost because the Roman Catholic hierarchy had total control of the country and the people at that time in the early middle 50s. So, as far as I was concerned, to me, everyone was Catholic. All my neighbours, friends, relatives, schoolmates, everyone. Occasionally you would meet a Protestant and you view them as sort of a bit odd. But everyone was Roman Catholic, except my father. He was now one of Jehovah's Witnesses. And I want to say now that he wasn't the typical, it's only now as I look back I realise, he wasn't a typical Jehovah's Witness. Because I used to see him kneeling when he prayed, which was something that I rarely saw Jehovah's Witnesses do. Not that that's mandatory, but it does tell you something about a man. I used to see him always reading his Bible, rather than the publications. I even remember that as a child. He loved the Bible. He was always quoting the Bible. So my father was a man who had a natural love of God's Word, and he was a self-educated man and a thinking man, and always trained me all my life to think and reason and question and probe. So for the following 12 years, he really lived as a Christian. Every single thing he tried to do it for Jehovah God, out of the sincerity of his heart. And I knew he was a good man. And so even though he lost his children and was threatened with prison, we were made wards of court, they forbade him to teach us the Bible. But he did in his own way, through example, most of the time. But I wasn't interested in religion. And he got cancer in 1967 and died on the 2nd of April. But it was while he was dying that I saw what a courageous man he was. I would go up to him each day, and he would tell me things about his God, his Father in heaven, God's purpose for the earth. And he said that I wasn't afraid of the truth, and if I studied the Bible, I would see what the truth was. And he never spoke to me much about the organization, but he always enjoyed going to the meetings. He was from a very poor background, and even my father was a child, he had no shoes, but he bought himself a dictionary and was anxious to know about life and God and things like that. So anyway, the night he died, I knew that the fundamentals of his religion were true. And I remember I was at a film called The Bible with my girlfriend, and that night I baptized myself in the bath because I wanted to be a Christian from that night. And I've tried from the 2nd of April, 10 o'clock, 1967. I studied the Bible with a very nice couple, Edwin and Emmy Ridgewell, and they've since died. They were in their 90s recently when they died. And so I got the flavor of the history of the background of Jehovah's Witnesses during the 1914 period, the 20s, the 30s, the 40s, the 50s, and all that they went through to establish freedom of worship. I didn't realize that in the 80s that would be reversed, and they would have become tyrannical against others who desired that similar freedom. So for 15 years I have served Jehovah God with all my heart, soul, mind and strength. I pioneered for 12 years and thoroughly enjoyed it. I was involved in a lot of things among the witnesses. For example, I helped to establish a charity to help special pioneers and poor brothers and sisters and to help build kingdom halls, and we established that legally. I was the marriage registrar. I was the presiding overseer, the secretary. I was involved with the closed circuit TV each year. I was assistant on with the news representative. I was, as I mentioned, a pioneer. I had many Bible studies. I publicly preached every Friday in the centre of the city with a stand and all the society's publications and with a number of different Bible translations. And we distributed thousands of tracts to the public. I'll send you a photograph of what we used to do there, although I was forbidden to do that by the branch office later on, after 18 months. And I loved promoting the interests of true worship. I wrote, for example, a personal letter, if I think of it, I'll enclose it to you, to 6,400 Roman Catholic priests. I wrote to every single Roman Catholic priest in Ireland, and I had 77 replies. 50 of them were offensive, and 20 were fairly nice. One time it bothered me that we weren't calling on the businessmen in our territory. So I wrote a letter to 6,000 businessmen and posted it to them. And so I had a deep interest in promoting Christianity. But when I became an elder, I began to see that not everyone would speak the truth. And I told many lies before I became a Christian in 1967. But as God is my witness, I have not told one lie since. And I shall not tell a lie if I can help it. Because I love truth, and my father loved truth. And when I was a child, if I stole something or hit someone, I might get a beating. But if I told a lie, my father would really leather me. Anyway, as the years went on, it was the coldness of so many, the calculatedness of everything that bothered me. The poor were ignored, I felt. And I wanted to go collecting money for hospitals, and I knew that would make me appear odd. The pressure bothered me. I used to see families bringing sleeping children to meetings, and then when the children would wake up, they'd have to start smacking them because they were bold, or naughty, as you might say. And there was a lack. I thought that was wrong, that it was unnecessary. We always spoke about meeting regularly, from Deuteronomy to Scripture, about meeting regularly, gathered together, the men, the women, and the little ones. But we never quoted a scripture above that where it says once every 7 years. So I felt the pressure was unnecessary. I felt there was a lack of intellectual freedom. I am a reader. I have many books. Many of my books centre on the Bible, the history of the Bible, the history of Christianity. And I noticed that brothers tended to frown when I would bring in unusual points. I also noticed that among many Jehovah's Witnesses, there was no real friends. There was a surface friendliness. And many of them are genuine people, there's no doubt, but something is blocking that letting yourself go with someone who you want to be a real friend with. And there was a tremendous amount of calculation, which I felt somehow it was wrong. Well, I went over to the branch a couple of years ago and I told them about, I felt we were ignoring the poor. I told them I felt we were wrong in 1914. That I hoped we were right, I believed it, but I desired the freedom to express it. I said there was fear in the organisation, and there shouldn't be. I didn't agree with the written records on disfellowshippings, because I noticed that in Barnes' commentary, Albert Barnes' commentary, that in the early church that wasn't done. I noticed there was a great deal of emphasis on society procedure. And I know enough about Christian history to know that when you elevate an organization, you denigrate the spirit of Christianity because of what Jesus said. Where two or three gather in my name, there I am in their midst. And it's the spirit that counts, not the letter of the law. So these were the things that were on my mind. I love people. I love naturalness. I love music. I love taking my wife out for a meal. I love my friends. I love truth. I love God's word, the Bible. I love his kingdom. But I hate and detest hypocrisy. And I hate and detest lies with all my heart. And I don't care what the price is. I will speak the truth. I used to have a saying with all my friends who are special pioneers and missionaries that we sometimes confuse, we meaning Jehovah's Witnesses, confuse maturity with silence. And it's only now I realize that that silence is fear and weakness and confusion. Anyway, things didn't sit right in my mind. I read about 80 books against Jehovah's Witnesses, and I still believed we had the truth. But I hope I was honest enough to recognize that a number of things in these books really didn't sit right with me. I remember speaking to Ed Gruss on the phone once, and he made the point that I was the exception. And so many people were telling me I was the exception among Jehovah's Witnesses, and I didn't want to believe I was the exception, that I wanted to believe all Jehovah's Witnesses didn't gossip and didn't tell lies and didn't. And all of them read their Bibles every day and wanted to do what was right from their heart. And there's no doubt that many of them do. I began to say that I was a Christian in association with Jehovah's Witnesses. And when I stood out publicly each Friday all day, talking to people and passers-by, giving them out tracts, I began to realize that there are many people with valid points of view. And I came to hate the doctrine that only Jehovah's Witnesses will survive the end of this system. And one of the local born-again ministers gave me a book on a debate that Russell had with Eaton, Dr. Eaton, I think his name was. And in that debate, Russell devastated the clergyman's idea that only those who were reborn of the Spirit would gain everlasting life, and everyone else would perish in hellfire. Russell believed all men would receive an equal opportunity for everlasting life one day. All men, and that those obviously who were reborn or born again would rule with Christ, whether his government would be in heaven or on earth. It doesn't bother me much. The fact is, he has a government and it's coming, and where he chooses it to be, that's where those who are truly reborn with his Spirit shall be. Anyway, Russell's writings fascinated me. He was a terrific man. So, with these thoughts in mind, I read an article in Newsweek magazine about last year, Are They False Witnesses? And that disturbed me, although I wrote to Newsweek and I rang the editor and I felt there was a number of inaccuracies in it, because I have had many articles published in defense of Jehovah's Witnesses. And the one in Newsweek disturbed me. But when the magazine, Time magazine, I've had a subscription for it for years, when it was delivered to me, it was the circuit overseer's visit, and I was rushing out. There was a special pioneer with me, and he took it out of the envelope it comes in, and he saw the article and read it, and his immediate reaction was, Ray Franz didn't get $10,000. Well, I was fascinated by this. So I read it and reread it and read it and reread it that day, and it struck a chord in me, especially where Ray Franz said that we were producing people who are outwardly moral, but inwardly lacked the qualities of mercy, justice, and kindness. That really struck a chord in me. And also where he said that he did not believe there was another organization that insisted on such conformity, 100% conformity. Well, I rang the writers of those articles in New York and Alabama, and they said he was a very nice man. And then I rang Peter Gregerson and Ray Franz, and if they had started attacking the organization, I probably would have put the phone down in a dignified manner. I would have terminated the discussion. But because they didn't, I felt that they had something of interest. And so I said, would you mind if I visited you? Because I love truth, I'm not afraid of the truth. And so they very kindly invited me over, Peter Gregerson. So that night, I invited Martin Merriman to come to my home. And I said, read that, Martin. This was about 1 o'clock in the morning, in fact. It was bothering me so much. So Martin is another lover of truth. He's been over to Peter Gregerson twice, in fact. He came back a few weeks ago for the second time. He took his wife Elizabeth with him. So Martin said, I think there's truth in it. And I said, so do I. Do you want to come with me to check it out? So Martin said, definitely. So we went together to Ray Franz. We flew to New York for one evening, and we flew down to Alabama, Atlanta Airport. Ray Franz picked us up. And I knew almost immediately that this man was an honest, godly man. And when I found out that he was involved in publishing the aid book, writing the aid book with Eddie Dunlap, and I spoke to Eddie Dunlap on the phone, and I met Peter Gregerson, and these men are genuine Christians, godly men, lovers of truth. They're not perfect men, but they're lovers of truth, and that's what counts to me anyway. So when I stayed 5 days and five nights with him, and so did Martin, and we were astonished. And the evening we were going away, we were singing songs. I felt that I could change it from within the organization. I'm not perturbed necessarily by weakness or duplicity, necessarily. I see that where there are humans, these things will happen. It took a while to work. It was like a seed in me growing. But that Saturday night we were leaving. We were singing songs, and I said to Martin, "Why aren't you singing?" And he said, "John, I'm brokenhearted." In other words, the organization collapsed for him almost immediately. I thought that it was God's organization, although I had stopped using that expression, funny enough. But I still felt God was using those men in Brooklyn somehow. But that there were serious cracks in the structure. I knew there was, but I felt, well, look what Jehovah's Witnesses did to each other in the Hebrew times, in the Old Testament. And what happened today in the last 50 years or so, 40, 30, it didn't perturb me that much. So we flew home. We then went out to California and to Texas and to friends of mine, and they said, sure, they read the Time article. They said, both of them said the same thing, that Brooklyn went to get Ray Franz because he knew too much, which astonished me. But when I found out that the society tried to change 1914 to 1957, that they let the Malawi brothers die, some of the wives were raped having babies. In fact, I remember ringing the ambassador in Malawi about this. His name was Banda, but he wasn't related to that, expressing my revulsion at what they were doing. But if I had known then that the society in Brooklyn actually were allowing the Mexican brothers hold a similar political card, and in fact were bribing officials to purchase that card, and that when Ray Franz asked for it to be discussed, they refused. If I'd known that then, I wouldn't have waited another 5 years. But anyway, when you believe God are using men, it's easy to believe everything they're teaching after that. So once I began to realize that they were just men, that they had no special wisdom, in fact, many of them, I can now see from the articles that's been written, many of them are even ignorant of Christian history. And I can't understand sometimes why they cannot see that the more narrow they become, the more inevitable a massive split is becoming in the organization. Because genuine Christians long for freedom, and many Jehovah's Witnesses are genuine. So, from California, I rang Jack Barr, who's been a friend of my family for 15 years. I wrote to him 2 years ago with about 12 questions, which he never replied. He gave me an acknowledgement, which I appreciated, but he never answered one of those questions, and that's over 18 months ago. I rang Jack from California. I told him, in the innocence of my heart, where Martin and I had been. We'd been down with Ray Franz, Jack. We'd been down with Peter Gregerson. And he was amazed, and he says, "John, do you think that was wise?" I said, "No, Jack. From an organizational point of view, that was very unwise. But from the point of view of truth and a love of truth, I believe it was wise. Because you taught my father... your wife and yourself influenced me to love truth, and my father to love truth, and you're a friend of Ernie Harrison, and he loves truth." And I said, "We've nothing to hide. Truth has nothing to be afraid of. It's error that fears examination." So I said, "Jack, Martin and I would like to meet with our governing body." And remember, we had the greatest of respect for our governing body, even at that point. And the tape, I'll just get onto this now. So I was to ring back Lyman Swingle the next morning. Jack was having breakfast with him, and Jack was willing, apparently. He was willing for this meeting because Ray Fran says that he's been disturbed over what's happened. Because Hewitt Chitty was another English brother, and he had resigned, but I don't know the exact reasons why, but Jack probably knows. So we rang back Lyman Swingle the next morning. In fact, I rang Jack's wife, Mildred, and she said, yes, Jack was rushing out and I was to ring Lyman Swingle. So we rang Lyman. Well, I could immediately tell that no, they wouldn't agree with it. He said that I was like a knight in shining armour flying halfway across the world to right all the wrongs. And I said, no, I didn't look at it that way when he said that to me. He said we were disobedient to the society. We shouldn't have gone down and spoke to Peter Gregerson and Ray Franz. We knew they were disfellowshipped and one had resigned. And I said, well, that may be true, but I said, we also spoke with their wives, and they're not disfellowshipped. But apart from that, I said, we don't feel we've done anything wrong. We're telling you what we've done. We're disturbed. The brothers in Ireland will be very disturbed over all this. And we simply want to talk, to ask some questions, not to accuse anyone of anything. And so he wouldn't listen to what we had to say. I thanked him very much for all the work the governing body had done on our behalf. But Martin gets a little bit hotter than I do, so he grabbed the phone off me. And he said, "Brother Swingle," he said, "my name is Martin Merriman." He said, "For 14 years, I have believed that our leaders in Brooklyn were not like the clergy in Rome." I said, "I knew as a Catholic I couldn't go over and meet the cardinals and the Pope." But he said, "The brothers in Ireland do not believe that if I've come over here and I want to speak to my governing body and I go back and tell them that you've refused to meet with us, they will not believe that." And I was giving Martin signals not to get too annoyed, that, you know, they were still our governing body, they still deserved respect and obedience, etc., etc. And Martin did calm down a little bit, but they wouldn't see us. So we spoke for 40 minutes almost, and in the end we both wished them Jehovah's blessing and thanked them for the work they did on our behalf. So we visited Brooklyn and we said nothing to our friends, met all the friends from Ireland up there, Bob Heavy and a few of the other ones up there. And we had a nice visit. We were there for a couple of days, met some lovely brothers. In fact, one brother made an interesting comment. He said he wanted to be in the service department, and we asked him why, and he said, "Well, that's where all the power is." And Martin and I looked at each other, but we said nothing to the young brother. Because loads of those brothers are lovely young men. So anyway, we came back to Ireland bitterly disappointed and very disturbed. Now, Martin and I promised each other we would only tell our wives what we had discovered, and one person each. He would tell George Tilbury and I would tell Cedric Burton. Cedric Burton is a circuit overseer over here in Ireland. So George heard the story and Cedric heard the story. Cedric said I should talk to Arthur Matthews. He's the branch servant, and I agreed. Arthur's a very nice man. He's been a personal friend of mine for years, and my wife said I should talk to Arthur, which I agreed. Fred Metcalf and Peter Andrews are totally blind. They only can see and listen to what the society tells them to see and listen to. So the phone rang. Funny enough, I gave the talk in the Dublin North congregation, the branch congregation, that very Sunday. And they knew where I'd been, because Lloyd Barry had visited that Saturday, and he'd been berating us indirectly by saying, "Brothers are playing with fire, visiting disfellowship people in their homes." I don't remember him saying that, but others said he said that. So my brother Gerard went up and asked, why was Ray Franz disfellowship for having a meal with his friend? And he said, "Gerard, I wasn't there, but Gerard, I was there, but not with Gerard," when he asked Lloyd Barry. And he said, "Lloyd Barry had a look of hate in his eyes and said, 'We don't comment on disfellowshipped persons.'" And mentioned Gerard's name to another member of the branch committee, Peter Andrews. So I gave the talk that Sunday, and the brother, Lloyd Barry, yes, he wasn't there. He was in bed. He didn't come to the meeting that particular morning. And I remembered what Ray had said, that many of them don't go to many of the meetings or don't go out on the doors much themselves. So they didn't turn up. Maybe he wasn't well, I don't know. So the next few days, Arthur Matthews rang me, said they had heard where we were, they wanted to talk to me. I said, "Good, Arthur, I wanted to talk to you. Cedric said I should, Yvonne said I should." So I went, Martin and I went over, we were there for about 2.5 hours, and Peter Andrews said we went against God's law, and Martin got real hot and said, "You show me where I went against God's law." And he couldn't. And what happened was that I told Arthur Matthews that I was not going to reveal everything in front of Peter Andrews. I said, "I would if Fred Metcalf was there, but he was away." And he said, "Why?" And I said, "Well, because Peter Andrews is not a thinking person. He's not particularly well educated, and he's not a Bible student." Because I knew that this was dynamite, what we had discovered from Ray Franz about what's really happening in Brooklyn. So we went over and we spoke, and Arthur Matthews rang me back the next day. But incidentally, while we were there, Martin said, "Do you want us to tell you lies and say we were with Sister Franz and Sister Gregerson? Because we also did a little business on the satellite aerials. That's another business that I'm getting into. My business is TV antennas." So we were there with them about 2.5 hours, and we had a nice pleasant time. And Arthur rang me the next morning, and he said that in all the discussion, he forgot to ask, were we going to correspond with Ray Friends and Peter Gregerson? And I, at that point, Martin and I had already agreed we weren't going to talk about it for 6 months, so I said no, but I did want to talk to Arthur personally, man to man. He said he was busy. I said, well, not right now, maybe in 5 or 6 months. So he agreed, and I wrote to him 6 months later, reminding him. So I said I didn't want to discuss these serious issues over the phone, that I had documentation, and I agreed not to reveal these matters or correspond with Ray Friends or Peter Gregerson, but I said I was going to write to them one more time to thank them for their hospitality, as I felt that was mannerly. And that's how we left it. Well, what happened was I agreed to change congregations, because in the central congregation where Martin was, the elders there, most of them are loving men, and I grew up with them. But the men in Clondalkin congregation are very cold and very harsh. So I knew I had to switch congregations, because if they knew where I was, there would be a lot of trouble. I knew exactly what would have happened, possibly. So I told the elders I was leaving, and they all begged me to stay. Now, I'm a very different man to the five elders. They go along with everything the society says, whereas I'm inclined to question everything until I'm certain in my own mind that it's right. So when I told them I was leaving, they begged me to stay. I was so impressed at their offers of me to stay that I even told them I would reconsider it and let them know in a week. So when I did, they still insisted that I should stay. And I told them no, I had decided I was going to leave. Well, the next night they met without me to discuss the letter about me being an elder in the other congregation. And lo and behold, when the elder came that night, the following night, Andrew Prizik, to tell me, they had refused to give me a recommendation as an elder in the other congregation. And listen to this, these are the six reasons. One, I preached in the city of Dublin without permission, standing outside the local post office with all the society's books. That's supposed to be a reason. Two, I forgot to review my instruction talk. I didn't review my instruction talk. Reason is I forgot. Three, I once said we could be kind to disfellowship persons. Four, I once said about 7 years ago that you didn't have to go out knocking on doors if you were sick. Five, I asked a brother to take my group instead of the appointed ministerial servant, when in fact the appointed ministerial servant wasn't going to the group much and hadn't been on the service for the door-to-door service for about 6 months. And I was the field overseer, so I asked this brother to take the group that night because I didn't think the other servant would be there. That was the fifth. And the sixth, I put advertisements in the newspapers to get special pioneers' houses in an area where they were moving to serve, and ads in magazines to answer people's questions on Jehovah's Witnesses, and ads in the local educated newspaper, the Irish Times, to tell people the times of our meetings. And I didn't tell the body of elders I was putting these ads in. So I was very hurt about that. This was about 3 months. This was about 2 or 3 weeks after I came back from America in March. And they said, but they do want me to stay in Clondalkin in their congregation as an elder. But they just didn't feel for these reasons I could be an elder in the other congregation. Well, I was astonished at this. So I went over to the branch at 8 o'clock the next morning. And I had already phoned an elder that night, and he couldn't stop laughing. He said it was a joke. And he said, get them to put it in writing, because they've shamed not you, John, but themselves. So I went over to Arthur Matthews the next morning, and I reported them all for hypocrisy, because they were begging me to stay, serve as an elder with them, and then refused to give me a recommendation for those very petty reasons. And even the branch overseer said they wouldn't stop me from being an elder. Anyway, to cut a long story short, that was on the Saturday. My own brother Noel, who is an elder and still an elder, fighting from within at the moment, he said it was a joke what they had done. So I didn't go to the meeting that Sunday morning, and I rarely missed meetings, maybe two or three in many, many years. And I rang one of the elders, Liam Dowling, and I told him that if Martin Skinner, Dick Lowe, Andrew Prizik, or Colin Brown, they were the elders, if one of them couldn't make it that Sunday at 3 o'clock to my home, none of them were to come. So they all came, they were all there early, and When Andrew opened the meeting with prayer, I rebuked the five of them one by one, and I demonstrated, and I have the records of their unkindness, their lies, their gossip. I'd already rebuked two of them for gossip, particularly their hypocrisy, which I detest. And I spoke for an hour and a half, and they had all agreed they wouldn't interrupt me, and one by one I demonstrated that their points were petty, were unchristian, and I used the scriptures to rebuke them, and particularly the one where Jesus said, "What you want others to do to you, Matthew 7 verse 12, do the same thing to them." And I said, "I wouldn't have done it on one of you," because I had helped them in many ways over the years. Anyway, so it happened, and I rebuked them, and that started a sordid episode for about another 3 months, where they changed a letter, and they had a new letter, and they said that I confused independence for initiative. I ran ahead of the organization, and I refused to meet with two elders. Well, the business about refusing to meet with two elders isn't true, because I had met with two elders the week with them before I left the congregation, because one of them wanted to discuss why I put the ads in without their knowledge. In fact, those ads were in for years. He was just a new elder. He knew nothing about it. But I did meet with them. And I told them the reason I didn't like meeting with two elders is that once I had been tape recorded behind my back, not realizing it. Oh, yes, and that was by elders when I was handling a court case, a judicial matter. Now, I just want to get back to when I phoned the two members in the governing body. When we met with Arthur Matthews and Peter Andrews in the Dublin branch, they're two members of the branch committee, Arthur Matthews said to Martin Merriman, "Well, don't be too disappointed, Martin, for not meeting the governing body." He said, "The entire governing body heard your tape." And Martin said, "What tape?" He said, "When you phoned Lyman Swingle," he said, "your conversation was taped." And I think Arthur may have let that slip out. So Martin said, "That doesn't make me feel better, Arthur. That makes me feel worse, to think that we approached them innocently and they actually tape recorded us without our permission or knowledge, and then sent that tape over with Lloyd Barry for the Dublin branch. And those men were instructed, obviously, in a memo to check us out." Well, Martin and I were two elders. In fact, we're two of the first generation of Southern Irish elders, and I just can't imagine why they would have done such a thing to us. So, coming back now to the issue with the Clondalkin elders, and I had to, me leaving the congregation, there were other acts of cruelty and unkindness to me, which I was amazed about. So I wanted to get a branch committee, a special committee, to rebuke these men for their hypocrisy. So Fred Metcalf rang me and he said, "John, we want to talk to you." I said, "Fred," he's a member of the branch committee, he's a lovely brother. I said, "Fred, you know I've never been once disobedient to the branch. Whatever you say, I'll do." So I feel we should be, at that point, I felt we should be obedient to our shepherds, our Christian shepherds. Not that we should believe and do anything they say. Anyway, I went over and they said, and this is the essence of their meeting, they said that if I proceeded with the special committee to rebuke these five elders, that they would feel obligated to tell the special committee where I was in the United States. Well, I was astonished, and I started crying. I was very upset. And it wasn't until 2 months later that Martin Merriman's wife told my brother that I was bribed by the branch in Dublin. And in essence, that's what it is. In other words, if I proceeded to rebuke those five elders, who were very organizational men, whereas I sort of wasn't, and yet I loved the organization, that they would tell them where I was. So I was shocked, and I was glad it was over, because I went and shook all their hands, and three of them, two are away on holiday in Wales, and I was glad it was over. So I wanted to get down to the business of being a shepherd of the flock of God, as I understood it at that point. So I decided to not be an elder for a while. In fact, I decided that when I came back, that's what I mentioned to the Clondalkin elders, I wanted to have a rest. So what happened was, my friend's child was having an operation, and I discovered in America that the society knew that haemophiliacs were going through gallons of blood to get the factor VIII, and to a lesser extent factor 9, it's the blood clotting agent, and that there's documentation in the Brooklyn files showing that they know brothers and sisters who are haemophiliacs are feeding off blood, but they're refusing to publish it. And that they know that there's contradictions, that the since blood is a symbol of life, how can a symbol be of more value than the reality? And they know how it was adopted through Nathan Knorr's presidency in July 1945, how there was a time for about something like 20 years when blood transfusions were acceptable and vaccinations were unacceptable. Now it's the reverse, etc., like transplants, etc., etc. So my friend's child, so I told him I felt we were wrong on this. Now that's all, I said, a few other things on that issue. But then my brother, Gerard, his wife had a baby, and it was born with diaphragmatic hernia, and it died two days later. I took the funeral. And I said to my wife, I said, Yvonne, I'm trapped. She said, what do you mean? I said, I'm going to be disfellowshipped. She said, why? I said, well, I believe we're wrong on the blood, because I had to say it to my brother Gerard, and he immediately trusted what I said, because I wouldn't have said it without a lot of study, thought, and meditation. And he went and told the hospital authorities that his child was to have blood, because they had just made it a ward of court if it needed it. But as it turned out, the child was too seriously ill, so it died. But I said to my wife in the hospital, I said, darling, I said, I'm trapped. And she said, why? I said, because, number one, I will not tell a lie on the blood I was referring to. If somebody needs help and they come to my home, I will not pass the buck to another elder. I will not refuse to help them. I will not tell lies. I said, I'm trapped. I will be disfellowshipped. They won't. There's no room to express your Christian conscience in this area. So we went on holiday to Spain a week or two after that, and we were with Cedric and Kathleen Burton. He's a circuit overseer here. Beautiful brother. And he made the point that I should just say nothing, but I said, Cedric, I can't. I said, I can't. A man must speak out and must believe, must say what he believes is true. Surely that's the right thing to do. Anyway, I got home 2 weeks later, 3 weeks later or so. We were in England as well. And I was literally not home 24 hours when the phone rang. And a brother's wife was in hospital. Her liver was malfunctioning. Her blood was clotting. She wasn't even baptized. And he asked me to go down to strengthen her. I went down with Martin. We had a look. It wasn't too serious. So I rang him. I took him to breakfast. Told him the whole story. I wanted him to decide. And not me. Since it would have made me a hypocrite. And that's something I cannot be. So I knew that I had to start speaking. So I wrote to Arthur Matthews. And I spoke to a few of my personal friends around the country. And there was immediately there was uproar. So I typed out a letter of resignation ready to see what would happen. And Arthur and Olive Matthews were coming to dinner that Sunday. And they cancelled the dinner, which I would view as a prejudging of me. But Yvonne, my wife, pleaded with him to come and talk, at least talk. So he came that night and he was here for 5 1/4 hours in my study. And I told him the whole story about what happened in the United States, about the lies the society are publishing. They know it. They know we have documented evidence of it. They're calling people animals and sex fiends and all sorts of unpleasant names. In fact, in next year's yearbook, which I have in my possession, over 20 times from the letter of Jude, over 20 times from April 1st to the end of the year, shocking names are called to people who have left or disassociated themselves or have tried to make the brothers see that not all is well up in the headquarters. You'll notice that yourself if you get a copy of it. So what happened was a circuit overseer came in, Ewan Watt, on a Tuesday night at a meeting, and he asked to meet with me. I met with him in a local cafe. We had a cup of coffee too, in fact, and he said to me that there was a lot of people hurt and upset over things that I had said to them. And I said, well, I've only been speaking to my personal friends, and maybe they've spoken to one or two, but I swore people to secrecy, because I knew that this was dynamite. So I said, well, he wanted me to meet with four judges, four brothers, specially called in, the very next night. I said, well, that's very rather premature. I said, I'd like you to read the documentation in my possession. He said, documents make no difference, he said. It doesn't matter what's right or wrong, true or false on this issue. What matters is John May talking. There, that's the essence of what he said. So I put the meeting off till that Friday to give myself time to think. It was all happening so quick. So he asked to speak to Martin Merriman, which he did in the car. So after about half an hour of talking with Martin, I got Martin out of the car. I said, Martin, he's not interested in what's true or false, right or wrong. He won't read the documents. And he said to me, they're probably forged. I said, look, they're on the Society's own letterheads. They can be easily verified. But he wouldn't listen. And Martin said, he said the same to me, or words similar. Said, do you want to resign tonight? He said, no, I'm going to fight from within. So my wife and I resigned. We had a letter of resignation announced that night. And just by a coincidence, Peter Doyle, who's a personal friend of mine, he resigned as an elder that night as well, because it was getting too much for him. And another friend of mine, Lark Gaffney, he resigned as a brother that night because of all this, and he detested the hypocrisy that was taking place. But he since took it back, and he's fighting from within. But that night he brought me back in front of an elder and shook my hand. He said, look, there's the evidence, and I'm going to continue to shake John May's hand. So that night there was uproar, as you can imagine, in the congregation, because nobody suspected anything. And my wife, of course, was upset. But 21 brothers and sisters, we all met with us that night, and we ate and drank. And that'll give you the idea, some idea of how the Irish will not accept dictatorial commands from foreign lands, possibly because of the history of the Irish, having suffered for 800 years and being told by the British, the English, what to do and how to do it and who to say hello to and all the rest of it. So the Irish people are much more friendly people, apparently. Now, they are really in their hearts. They're much more natural. They're not as reserved. They're like the Spanish. They're very outgoing. So we resigned on the 28th of September. And Martin Merriman had already resigned as a servant 3 months prior to that. Well, there was uproar, as you can imagine. Martin then met the following Saturday and took 20 witnesses with him. 20 witnesses. And every one of them denied that he was an apostate. And he was exonerated, and there was 3 talks given which cleared Martin Merriman and tried to put a stamp on the talk of apostasy. But a few weeks later, Martin and Liz resigned because they felt how the cold ones were ignoring them, etc. But they were going to resign anyway, and that's the night before they flew back to America. Not that Ray Franz has anything to offer us. He's just a Christian. Not that I have anything to offer our group or Martin. We're just Christians, and we're just happy to serve our brothers. So then Jared, my brother, has resigned. John Maxwell has resigned, and we heard Evelyn Gallagher resigned last week. Today is the 8th of December. A brother came in. He and his wife are refusing to go to any more meetings. My own brother Derek and his wife have not gone to any more meetings. We had 32 at our little group last week, and there are other resignations in the wind. Well, for a small country, this is devastating. My own postman came this morning, and I couldn't tell you what he said, what he thinks about that September 15th watchtower. Because he works with people who are, he knows people who are Jehovah's Witnesses. It's a small community, you see, and everybody knows everybody. And I met a lady yesterday, and she said that, John, I'm going to say something that's going to hurt you. And I said, go ahead, I don't mind. She said, I think Jehovah's Witnesses are worse than the Roman Catholic Church in this area of hurting people. I says, well, it shouldn't have happened. It was beautiful, but it's tragic. And it's simply that they've gone beyond the things that are written. So we have a little group now, and last Wednesday we had 32 in attendance. We had a Baptist minister here, we had a Roman Catholic priest here, and they've had difficulties with their movements. I myself, because of the articles I've written in newspapers and some radio and TV publicity, have possibly been the most well-known witness in Ireland, and I'm getting letters and phone calls from all over the country. I'll give it a typical illustration. A brother and sister have invited us to a meal in the country just the other day, and over 150 Irish brothers and sisters reject that watchtower. And the 2 elders came to a brother last Tuesday night, Terry Mulvaney, and said to him that, was it true he'd had a meal with me this week? He said no. And they said last week, and he said no. And they tried to say, what was he talking about? Well, the Irish people won't have that FBI carry-on. To them, that's an inquisition. And he was carrying his letter of resignation as a ministerial servant on him, and he just said He said, there's my letter of resignation, and you men are crazy if you think, and you, the other elders are crazy, if you think that I am going to walk straight past my personal friends when I know they're not wicked, and you know they're not wicked, so it's crazy, this whole thing. And may I say that that is the average reaction of the average witness. It is crazy to think that they can split families. The Irish are a very family-oriented people, very close. They may have arguments and differences, but they love each other. Although there is this awful trouble in Northern Ireland, I acknowledge, which is shocking. But I'm speaking now about the Republic of Ireland, where 95% are Roman Catholics, and it's a very small, very close-knit community. So, 32 are here last Wednesday. I don't know how many will be here tonight. We have ads in the newspapers. I've written to over 20 hospitals and have 20 more hospitals to write to. We're hoping to visit sick children and neglected children in hospitals. We're helping an organisation, I think it's called Concern, tonight, and our little group is going to donate £10, and that will help 500 children save 500 children from going blind. And if there's £20, we'll save 1,000 children from going blind. So our group, we're going to donate that tonight. So to me, that's real Christian service. So I can't wait to tell the little family Christian community that tonight. We're holding a miniature convention, our assembly, this January 2nd, and we're going to publicly advertise it in all the newspapers. We're calling a press conference in January sometime. We're having a party for the children in January, and all the local family heads are holding our first meeting this Sunday to discuss our community, to discuss the assembly. We've had our first leaflets printed today, which reminds me, I won't post this letter to you till I get the leaflets. I'm getting them at 3 o'clock this afternoon. It's 2:15 now, so I'll send you the leaflets. And so it's very exciting. I'll tell you what I'm particularly enjoying, Jim, because I just realised I haven't mentioned your name yet, Jim Penton. Jim, what I'm really enjoying is the freedom to speak my mind, to speak my heart. The actual freedom to say to a question, well, I don't know. Well, I don't see it that way. Well, that's your point of view, and I think your point of view is fascinating. And to allow for each other's point of view. And that's what we're promoting. So my brother Gerard has resigned, and he is fairly wealthy. He's supporting our group in every way. I'm doing okay in business, and so it's not causing us any financial difficulty. We're doing very well. If you could send another subscription over, I'll give you the address in the letter. We'll leave that for the letter. So many, many brothers and sisters are calling day and night almost to my home, ringing, calling, writing, to express their support. A Catholic lady rang the other day from Tipperary while one of the elders was here collecting some documents, and said she admired and respected our courage in this. So my wife was reared as one of Jehovah's Witnesses, and it's been an eye-opener for her to see the coldness, to see the shallowness, to see the lack of kindness when you question or challenge the leadership. I loved and respected them, but as my friend in England, Jeff Girling, as he said, that when I asked him in England this year, he said the society were hysterical for loyalty at the moment. And that's before I told him anything. He has since read the documents, and he said he's going to take a stand against them. If he's disfellowshipped, he doesn't care. He's quite a student of Christian history. He's going to the university in England, in Nottingham at the moment. And so we have friends all over the country who are reading the documents, who are thinking, who are watching what's happening here. So on the 2nd of January, in the Lord Mayor's residence in the Mansion House in Dublin, we're holding our convention. If you were thinking of sending a telegram, we'll be sending your group one. You wouldn't get it to the Mansion House because everything would be closed down then. If you were thinking of sending a telegram or anything like that, send it to my home. Well in advance, due to the Christmas rush, that would be nice for the brothers to know that we have brothers in Canada and America who are in harmony and in unity with us. I think it's true what you said to me on the phone one day, Jim, that it's difficult for the average brother to conceive of serving God individually, as an individual. They seem to need a structure, but I haven't written one thing yet as a charter My charter is God's word. My mandate are the teachings of Jesus. The purpose is the promotion of Christian teachings and love and kindness. If I do write anything, it will be very simple and very loose. And I will leave all the judging to God, all the questions in his hand. He can answer them far better than I can. So I'm coming towards the end of the tape. I've spoken for much longer than I intended to. I would say to you brothers and sisters over there, don't be afraid. Serve Jehovah with all your hearts. If some start believing the Trinity, well, allow for that. Many godly men have believed the Trinity down through human history. I like what one of the Roman emperors once said. If God is offended, well, he can handle it. Well, he actually said, if the gods are offended, they can handle it. Let them handle it. But Jehovah isn't offended at men's innocence or ignorance. He understands our backgrounds, our sociological conditioning, our psychological conditioning, our educational standard. He can grasp all that and allow for all that. And that's why I feel great love for people. And if we can as humans, how much more so our loving Father in heaven. And in my prayers, I've been much closer. I've been speaking to Jesus. In fact, I did ignore him over the years, but I have been speaking to him much more since, and I find that great. I find that in Ireland now, there's a great deal of interest in the Bible, and Jehovah's Witnesses are capitalizing on that, as are the Mormons and the Way and other groups, and it doesn't bother me anymore. We will express Christianity in our community as we understand it, and I think if we can express the Spirit each week, each day, that's what it's all about. We don't have all the answers. I feel very sorry for Jehovah's Witnesses as an organization. I wrote to Jack Barr last week, and I wrote, as you Americans say, I shot from the hip. I spoke straight to him. I sent him the cutting. He came here. There 500 people met in a hotel in Dunleary, and I was the only one that was disassociated that night. It was disgraceful. He never really answered one of the questions. Bob Pevy came from Brooklyn with him, who's a nice man himself. In fact, he said hello to me that night. But over 50 people said hello to me that evening at the meeting. That'll give you some idea of the Irish brothers and sisters. Now, many didn't. I freely acknowledge that, but it didn't bother me because I was with real friends. And when Fred Metcalf stood up there and asked for a clap to a demonstration of loyalty for the governing body, over 30 people refused to clap, but there was 12 in my row, and not one of us clapped. Now, remember, I was the only one disassociated at that time. I didn't want my wife to come that night to experience this. It's vicious cruelty. That's all I can call it, what I think it is. But I'll never retaliate. I'll never become a Watchtower basher. The Watchtower Society has a fine purpose, a fine charter, written by a fine man, Charles Taze Russell. It has become a parody. It has become a religion of rules and regulations. The joy is gone. Although I must admit, I was very joyful as one of Jehovah's Witnesses, because I was serving God as a Christian among Jehovah's Witnesses. So anyway, as I said, I've said enough. What else can I say? Give you a little background to the witnesses over here. They're in the country about a bit over maybe 70 or 80 years. Charles Taze Russell came here about 1910. The work really only got going here after the Second World War in the Republic, and it's been very, very slow. Very few Catholics have converted. But with international press, television, Ireland itself, the clergy in Ireland are losing their grip on the people. And even we are benefiting, our group, because someone rang yesterday, saw one of the ads, and they're coming tonight. So things are going very well. Each day to me is a joy as a Christian. Each day is a challenge. Something new, something unusual, something different happens every day. And I don't have to keep thinking now, am I being loyal to the organization? Is it pleasing to the organization? Or I don't have to worry about the spies who ring up and were reporting me behind my back for little things I might say or do in full innocence. And I just always felt we should be honest about our feelings and about how we felt. Anyway, it's been a pleasure talking to you. Jehovah bless you. There's a little bit left on the tape. If I think of anything else, I'll put it on. I'll conclude with Jesus' statement, if you remain in my word, emphasis, my word, you shall really know the truth, and the truth shall set you free. Jehovah bless you all. Bye-bye.